Well, we'll come back together for a little while. We've miles to travel, but we'll be humble, and we may not get much further. But anyhow, there was a good conversation starting before the cup of tea. Anybody have reflections on this, or a thought you had at the break time, or something that somebody said? I suppose it sounds terribly pious and so on to put Jesus at the heart of our schools, and yet, if we're to be serious about it, if we're going to make your school a Catholic school, then Jesus is the heart of Catholic faith. And I think there's powerful values, life-giving values of deep respect and inclusion and hospitality and what have you that we would have to model. Let me push on a little bit. Other deep values of Catholic faith, and we've said a lot of them already, and in many ways this is picking up more on a Catholic identity. Now Jesus is the foundation of our faith. But the Catholic tradition, and this may surprise you, at least at our best, we have a very positive understanding of the human person and of the whole person and of the potential goodness of the person. Now, that may not be the Catholicism you grew up with or the one I grew up with, but I can quote you chapter and verse that it was one of the issues in which we fell out with the reformers. When the Reformation, when Luther and Calvin, more so, was saying that the human person is a mass of peccati, a mass of sin and corruption, and they were saved only by the grace of God in Jesus Christ, gratia sola, because we're so corrupt that we can contribute nothing to the work of our salvation. He was quoting Paul to the Philippians. Catholicism, when it regrouped, came back and said that's not true. That the divine life was never lost to us, the divine spark is never quenched, that God's original grace outweighs original sin, and that we're not inherently corrupt, we're not inherently evil. In fact, we're basically good. Now, we're capable of dreadful sin and dreadful corruption and dreadful evil. We're capable of all of that, but we're not inevitably that way, and we can be brought along in ways that flourish. There's an innate goodness to us, that the divine image and likeness that you read about in Genesis 1 and in Genesis 2, the reading yesterday in the common lectionary, said that God breathed the breath of God's own life into Ha-Adam, into the earth person, and Adam became Nefesh. And it's very difficult to translate it, but I'm not a great scripture scholar, but I have friends who are. And it says Nefesh means alive with the life of God. That life of God is never lost to us. The great debate, the time of the Reformation, they said the Catholic response to Calvin was to say, well, how could God have become one of ourselves in Jesus if our human condition was simply corrupt? It would be saying that God was hell bound by sin. So the incarnation is the ultimate affirmation of the human condition and of our extraordinary potential and possibilities. In a sense, Mrs. Nyden was modeling this anthropology, this understanding of the human person, in how she treated Teddy and his two buddies. So it can permeate the whole school, the whole ethos of the school. And it's not that you let them off the hook and away with murder and all the rest of it, no, but yet, you see an innate goodness, an innate possibility there. All of the great movies about education, you know, Mr. Holland's Opus and all those movies, they're all about teachers who simply refuse to accept kids as bad or as lost or as going to hell in a bucket and said, no, they've got great potential, great possibility. It demands a holistic kind of education where you educate their heads, their hearts, their hands, to become fully alive to the glory of God. And the more fully alive they become, the more they give glory to God. Deep Catholic, positive outlook on life. We don't even recognize it. We don't even think about it. But in a sense, it's the same attitude toward life in the world as we have toward the person. Basically positive. A positive outlook on life in the world. There is a partnership of nature and grace. That grace is God's love at work. It's God's effective love. It's the Spirit of God empowering our own good efforts. That we can make a go of it. It encourages a whole sacramental outlook, to see more, to see God in all things. It gives a tremendous sense of meaning and purpose to life. I was telling my friends last night, that high school I went to, Lord of Mercy on Him, Joe Horn was our science teacher, and he was also a religion teacher. Father Joe Horn, an old oblate of Mary Immaculate, he was a terrible religion teacher, terrible. He was a marvelous science teacher. But if anybody gave me a sacramental outlook on life, it was Joe Horn in science class. And he'd say to a gentleman, look at that. Isn't that extraordinary? Isn't that amazing? And we could be looking through a microscope or a telescope. And he'd say, oh, do you see that? Do you see the design? And he never used God language in science class. And yet he gave us, he'd say, look at those worms. Aren't they amazing? What do you think of those worms? Aren't they the most beautiful worms you've ever seen? Jesus, Father, you know. You could come to see God in all things, Ignatius of Loyola. And that the Spirit is always there at work. That positive outlook. I was telling friends today about, there's an old man in my village, Joe. And Joe had a terrible life, terrible, terrible sickness, terrible poverty. And yet, I always remember, he worked at my grandfather's farm. And I worked alongside him. And you'd say to him, how are things, Joe? And he'd always say, not too bad. It was bad, you know, but not too bad. And Joe would come every day past our house, and my mother would go out and say, I loved how she would do it, because Joe would have died from the hunger if it wasn't for her. And she'd go out and she'd say, Joe, you know, I cooked too much dinner today, and I hate to see it go to waste. You'd do me a great favor if you come in and finish it up for me. He'd say, well, now, Mrs. Groom, you know, I've had my dinner already, but I hate to see good food go to waste. I will now. I'll come in and I'll finish it up for you. It was lovely how she maintained his dignity, and they both knew they were playing games. And yet, it was a lovely way. It was a lovely way it was a positive outlook. And as I said, it comes with our mother's milk, some of this, but it's deeply grounded in our Catholic faith because of God's grace, because of God's gift. Because it's all sacramental. The world is the theater of God's grace. It's where God's grace is at work. As Catholics, we always think of sacraments as the ones we celebrate in church, but the whole sacramental principle of Catholic faith is far broader. The seven sacraments are the tips of the iceberg to the sacramentality of life in the world, to see God in all things. Before you go to bed tonight, pause for a minute, and I bet you'll recognize at least one sacramental moment in the day, at least one God moment, and very often three, in the honor of the Blessed Trinity. They're always there. We often don't notice them. But it's a very positive outlook on life, and it lands a great transcendent ground. It gives meaning, it gives purpose to life. That is not eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It has great purpose and possibilities. Promotes a bonding with all people that were made for each other. This is deep Catholic values. In fact, indeed, it's what we mean by Catholic, that we're responsible for and to the whole human family, and that there's no limit. Catholic, our word Catholic, Catholos, literally means all are welcome, Catholos. James Joyce got it right in Finnegan's Wake. Catholic means here comes everybody, and everybody included in our care, and everybody included in our welcome. It's that kind of universal perspective. This is how Augustine and Prosper of Aquitaine, the other great fathers and mothers of the church, the first to call the Christian community Catholic, they meant it in this inclusive sense, this hospitable sense, that all are welcome and that we're responsible for everybody. And so you educate, our school should educate for the common good of all people and to form good citizens as well. A wisdom way of knowing is deep in Catholic faith. Now, it would take me too far afield late at night to explain this, and we have to move along. But there's a pedagogy, there's a way of teaching that pays attention to data, but also invites people to move to understanding, to make judgments, and to make decisions. This is classic Thomas Aquinas. And you see, the good education will often get people to pay attention to data and to understand it. But when we invite young people on to make judgments and decisions about what they're learning, that's when we educate for wisdom. We move beyond knowledge to wisdom for life that shapes their whole person, their outlook, their values, their self-understanding. We have to prepare them not just to make a living, but to have a life. And some of this, that way of knowing, that wisdom way of knowing is crucial to it. And it's critical reason, but it's also divine revelation. It's critical thinking, but also awareness of God's self-disclosure, working together as partners, committed to academic excellence. Yes, absolutely. And also formation in gospel values. And the key is to try to do both and to see these as partners, not as competitors, but as supporting each other. Let me bring you back into the conversation. We'll only do a little bit with this because we're going to run out of time, but that's all right. Maybe we've said enough. Faith and teaching faith. So I'm doing a little shift now, education from faith to education for faith. So I suppose my question to you, and I might have you chat about this for a minute, throughout the whole taught, should be taught throughout the whole curriculum, this faith, subtly, as I said, Joe Horn did it in science class better than he did in theology class, religion class. But what about explicit faith and education in faith? I mean, is it still feasible? I was saying to people last night in Dublin, this morning here, that I think it's easy enough to do religious education. You can do religious education the same way as you do math or science or social studies or geography. You can just dole it out in doses, take it as a discipline of learning and dole it out. But it doesn't do anything to people's lives. They'd be better off learning computers or something. I think there's greater possibility than that. I think there are ways to educate in faith. Faith in themselves, faith in others, faith in the world, faith in life. I mean, what a misery to go through life without faith. Life lived with faith is a lot richer than life lived without it. But in your opinion, is it still feasible for the curriculum of religious education in a Catholic school? What do you want students to know? This is a good question. Maybe answer this. What do you want students to know from the curriculum of religious education in your school? What do you want them to know? Or what do you want them to learn, I suppose you could ask. And how do you want them to know it? Think about that for a moment. What do you think? What is there possibility of educating for faith? Even in a Catholic school that's still rigorous and academic and not proselytizing or manipulating, respecting people's choices. And when you look and think about the religious education curriculum of your school, what do you want them to learn from it? What do you want them to know? And then at what level of their being? How do you want them to know it? It's easy enough to put it into their heads, get them to get honors in the Leaving Cert, religious education. But is that what we're about? What do you think? Anybody got a response to these questions?
A question that comes to mind.
Please.
For me, like in relation to that, you know, I personally don't feel that religion should be at the same level as an exam, same level as an ordinary subject like, you know, whatever, geography, history. And it has to be more to religion than recall.
Absolutely. But I suppose my question would be, do you have to choose either or? And this is why, this is the question, now we're not going to be able to do this justice at all tonight. But I think there is a way to teach it that is rigorous, that is academic, that is demanding, and yet that deeply touches people's lives. That you don't have to teach, there is a way to do it that isn't just like teaching science. And I think there is a way to do it with academic rigor that yet enriches people's lives, shapes their values, their outlook, their understanding, their sense of God. Yeah. It's very difficult. A lot depends on the pedagogy.
I was just about to make that point.
Yeah.
And also as well, a huge amount depends and would depend on how it's assessed.
How it's assessed. Yes, that's
it's
right.
It's only going to be assessed
that's fair
by
right.
means of a 2-hour exam.
Yeah.
If you could come up with different and more meaningful ways of assessing it.
Okay.
That's not a junior cert.
Yeah.
Or not
no, that's fair enough. And I mean, I'm an outsider to the context, and I deeply respect, you know, the situatedness of your question and so on. And it's easy for me to sound glib about it. I don't mean to do that. But I taught undergraduates at Boston College for 35 years. And then they gave me a day job. I haven't taught undergrads in about 6-7 years, because I direct a center. And I still teach graduate students, but not undergrads. But, and I had Muslims, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, all kinds of people in my courses. I taught a course called Catholicism 1, first semester, Catholicism 2, second semester, very creative. But I did it in a way that was rigorous, that was academic. The grade they get in theology is as much influential in whether they get into medical school or law school and all the rest of it. And yet I've students have come back for the last 20, 30 years saying that the course deeply touched their lives and made a difference. And my ultimate compliment, and I sound as if I'm being self-promoting, but my ultimate comment about 3 years ago when a Muslim man, Muhammad was his first name actually, came back for his 25th anniversary. And so he's like 45 or 50, pushing 50 now, to thank me that I'd made him a better Muslim from the course that he took with me on Catholicism. And it was rigorous, it was academic, and yet I think there's a way to do it. Let me push on a little bit, because this, your first name again was David. David. Thank you, David. I think it's integral to educate for faith. I think, and what I talk about is a life to faith. This is my life work in the next 10 minutes. I think you can teach a faith tradition so that people learn about it, and that's what David is talking about. They just learn about it and they pass the exam. Or you can teach it a way that they could learn from it for their lives and be enriched by it, or that they take it on as their identity. This is Michael Grimmett, a great English religious educator. I think we have to do it in a way that moves beyond teaching about it so they at least learn from it. Now, they may become card-carrying party members, but we can't force that. But we can at least do it in a way that they learn from, that they certainly learn about it, but they also learn from it. And I think it requires a religious curriculum of Catholic schools that gives persuasive access to the truths and spiritual wisdom of Christian faith, at least to learn from it. Let me push on. It requires a pedagogy that engages students' everyday lives. This is the key. That somehow takes what Paulo Freire, the great educator, and my own mentors, and I was blessed by, to takes the generative themes, that the stuff that matters to kids' lives and to their heart's desires, that it somehow engages them personally. And a lot depends on the questions you ask, and then gives them access to the scriptures and traditions of Christian faith, or whatever faith tradition you might be doing a course in world religions, and you're doing a day in Islam, Muslims, whatever. Lots of your, I'm sure your high school curriculum, secondary school curriculum has that opportunity. But whatever you're teaching, you teach it in a way that they could find wisdom in it, not just information. And they might take it on as their faith identity. I think the key for me is how he taught. And we're summarizing, and if I had time, I'd ask you how you imagine him teaching. But I think there's a whole pattern in how Jesus taught, and we can be inspired by it. And basically, he appealed to both logos and eros, to both reason and desire. So it could be critically academic, but also touch into people's hearts. I don't think you have to choose between them. I think there's a way to do it that does both. And I think this is what David is raising. Can we do it in a way that nurtures their faith identity, but also that they do blooming well in the exam? I think it's possible. I think the constant intent, when you look at Jesus' teaching, he was always trying to get people to integrate life and faith into a living faith. Now, I know I'm summarizing too quickly, but his overall pedagogy, the way of teaching, I describe it as he invited people to bring their lives to the faith he was preaching, and to take the faith he was preaching and bring it back into their lives. How did he do it? He constantly did it by beginning with the ordinary and everyday of people's lives. You'll not find a single incident in the New Testament where Jesus doesn't begin a teachable moment with something from ordinary everyday life, the lives of the people in front of him. A reign of God is like people sorting fish. The reign of God is like a sower who went out to sow some seed. The reign of God is like a parent who had two sons. And one of them asked for half the property. Reign of God is like a woman baking bread. The reign of God is like, look at the birds of the air, the lilies of the field. There's a beggar at the gate. People hiring workers. People beggar. The sun sets, the sun rises. Getting people constantly to stop and look at their lives. Engaging the stuff that mattered to them, the questions they were raising, the issues they were struggling with, the problems they had, the ordinary and everyday. But he often got them to look at their lives in a whole new way. So he turned their world upside down at times. Like the Samaritan becomes the neighbor, and the prodigal is welcomed home, and Lazarus goes off to the bosom of Abraham, and the rich man is gone to hell, and all the rest of it. But turning people's world upside down, because in the world of the time, poverty was seen as a curse from God, and wealth was seen as a blessing. He put it the other way around. So he began with people's ordinary everyday lives, got to think deeply about it, but then taught his gospel with authority, it says in Mark 1:22, and persuaded them by reason, by desire, but always to get them to begin to see for themselves with personal conviction, and of course to make some decisions about it, to follow and to put his wisdom to work. You see it writ large on the road to Emmaus. It goes all throughout his whole life, but I'll review this very quickly with you. But the text in Luke 24 says that very same day, Easter Sunday morning, two of the disciples are making their way to a village named Emmaus, discussing as they went along all that had happened. In the midst of their lively exchange, Jesus himself approached and began to walk along with them. And the scripture, but they were restrained from recognizing. You know, the scripture scholars have always wondered about why didn't he recognize them. The better question is, why didn't he introduce himself? He never does. But he begins by asking them then, what happened? Tell me about what's going on. And I think we have to begin there with young people. So what's going on in your life? What's happening? What's the problems? What are the struggles? What are the joys? What are the sorrows? And they tell him they say, well, aren't you? Are you the only one who doesn't know what went on in Jerusalem? And he says, what things? When you watch his pedagogy, he's drawing them in. He's talking about their own pains, their own hopes, their own shattered visions. They said, we were hoping he was the one who set Israel free. So he draws out their own realidad, their own, as Freire would call it, their own reality first, their own life in the world, their own pains, joys, sorrows. And only then, having in a sense elicited their own story and their shattered vision, only then does he share the story and vision of the faith community. Go home tonight or tomorrow night or whenever and take a look at this Luke 24:13-35 as a teacher, as an educator, and watch him. Extraordinary how he taught. And it's all throughout his public life, but it gets writ large on the road to Emmaus, that stranger. And it says, beginning then with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them every passage of scripture that referred to himself. No wonder they're on the road all day. And explained to them that the Messiah had to suffer so as to enter into his glory. They were looking for a political Messiah. He was a suffering Messiah. But he's all day. He does a thorough job of explaining the whole tradition. And no wonder they're on the road all day. All the scriptures that referred to himself. So he begins with their own reality, their own life in the world, their own reflection upon it, their own story and vision, whatever you want to call it. Then he lays out in a very rigorous, thorough way the story and vision of the faith community. And he still doesn't tell them what to see. The text says, by now they're near the village to which they were going. He acts as if he's going on further, but they press him. They go in to stay with him. And when he seats himself with them at table, he takes the bread, breaks it, blesses it, gives it, he blesses, he breaks, he gives it. And with that, their eyes are open and they see for themselves. Now, that's what you're looking for in good religious education, that people can come to see for themselves, not to see or simply repeat what you told them. That's learning about. But when you say to young people, now what do you think? Does that make any sense to you? Can you believe that? What difference would it make? Suppose you took it seriously. That's inviting them to see for themselves. And then, of course, inviting them to some kind. And the people in the story, they turn around and go back into Jerusalem. He disappears and they go back into Jerusalem to rejoin the life of faith. I think, and that's a picture of them, the three of them on the road. I took it myself. I think teaching any religion or any faith tradition, I think we have to somehow engage students' ordinary everyday lives with the real themes and issues and get them talking about it, thinking about it, reflecting on it. And then in the midst of that, I think we can give them access to the spiritual wisdom of Christian faith or of Muslim faith, whatever faith that you might be teaching, the story and the vision. And then you have to invite them, to encourage them to see for themselves what it might mean for their lives. I was doing an invitation class with a group of high school students. It was at an international conference of religious educators, a terrifying moment when your colleagues say, okay, Tom, let's see you do it. And I was teaching, they asked me to do something from the Islamic faith, and I picked the Islamic tradition of zakat, which is this extraordinary tradition in Islam of giving 2.5% of your income, not of your income, but of your assets every year to the poor. And I mean, I would never start lecturing about zakat. We started talking about poverty in the world and stories of poverty, statistics of poverty, how many children are dying of hunger every 10 minutes, every hour in the day. And physical hungers, of course, the ultimate hunger is hunger for food. But then there's also spiritual hunger and emotional hunger and hunger for love. And we got the young people talking about, I use statistics and resources. You can show a clip, you can show a YouTube on the plight of the hungry. And then you get them to reflect on why is there hunger? Why is there hunger in our world? There shouldn't be. We're perfectly capable of feeding the people. We've easily enough resources, and we don't. We don't have the will. We don't have the imagination. We don't have the courage. We don't have the generosity. We don't have the integrity. There's people left hungry for no reason at all. Why is there hungry? What can we do about it? So you get them talking and thinking about, and the hungers in their own lives, how they're hungry, and what are they hungry for, and what will satisfy their hungers. In the midst of that, then you can begin to say, there's this extraordinary Islamic tradition. And it comes out of a whole spirituality. It's not just you ought to give to the poor, but the whole thing is that everything is a gift from Allah, from God, and that we're simply the stewards of it, and that we have to give back. We're to be good stewards and give back at least a portion of it every year. And you can lay out the whole practice. Now, when you come together to see for themselves, it's not a question. You can't just say, okay, folks, everybody now, can anybody give me the definition of zakat? That's just teach them about it. Now, you want them to know the definition. Can anybody tell me what it is? Can anybody spread the word? This is how we typically teach. Most of the time, teachers teach, and then they ask students to tell them what they said. Well, why not ask them, what do you think of that tradition? Now, I don't want them to be, I'm not trying to make Muslims out of them. But yet I say, you know, I'm terribly confronted by that Muslim tradition. And I know that there's also, you can give deep echo into Christian faith, as I normally would, of Jesus talking about feeding the hungry and giving drink to the thirsty and all the rest of it, this deep, deep echo. So what do you think? Does it make any sense? Supposing we took it seriously, what responsibility do we have? How can we respond to the hungers in ourselves, in our hearts, in our world, in our village, in our society? But to begin with the themes and issues that beset our world, that beset their lives, to bring that to the resources, to the spiritual wisdom of great religious traditions, but invite them then to put them together. I think there's a way to do it. What do you think? A life to faith to life approach? Could it do both? Be formative, but also informative. So that indeed there would pass. I'm not saying you ought or you should. I don't know. I don't know enough to have a position, really, on should religion be an exam subject. But I think there could be a possibility in it being taken very seriously and rigorously and academically, and yet somehow being able to touch into the hearts and the desires and the lives and the issues of young people in a way that could enrich their lives, that could be a source of spiritual wisdom for their life, even if they don't become card-carrying party members, that they can learn from it and be enriched by it. You think about the Muslim tradition of praying five times a day, turning towards Mecca. I love to teach that section. to my students. Now, I'm not trying to get them to buy a prayer mat and turn toward Mecca, but I'm getting them to learn from that. And then you end up asking them, now, you know, is there a way that you might consider turning your mind and heart to God throughout the day? What would that look like? How would you do it? Is there anything in the Christian tradition that would encourage that? Of course there is. But finding it in Islam can help us to find it in our own tradition. Now, depending on what age level you're teaching and all the rest of it. Anyhow, give me some response to these questions. What do you think of a life, and I haven't done it any justice, Justin will advertise the book, Will There Be Faith, if you want to read about this process where I describe it in great detail, because I certainly haven't done it justice here. But just a little I've said about it, a life to faith to life approach. Does it have potential for your school? And I suppose the better question is, what can you do to support religious education in your school? Because you're key people. Boston College is an old Catholic Jesuit university. We've 20,000 students. It's one of the best Catholic universities in the country. There's 232 Catholic universities in the United States. Every one of our 230 universities requires theology as an academic subject. They must take 6 credits of theology. And they can be law students, medical students, engineering students, business students. They have to take 6 credits. And we teach it as a very rigorous academic discipline. Their grade that they get in theology will be as influential as any other grade in getting into law school or medical school or wherever they want to go. And yet they'll tell us at the end of it that it deeply, deeply touched their lives. We had a survey about 2 years ago of a 25th anniversary class, and we asked them to remember a course at Boston. There was 100 questions on the questionnaire, but to remember a course they had while a student at Boston College made a deep influence, a deep impact on their lives. 84% of them put down a theology course as having a deep impact on their personal life. And I think it's because of how we try to teach it, not the fact that we teach it. And there is a way to teach it where it'll mean diddly squit to their lives. But I think if we get them engaged, thinking about it for themselves, trying to see whatever they see for themselves, like that stranger on the road to Emmaus, start with their own lives, their interests, their questions, their issues, their joys, their sorrows. Bring that then to the tradition, but get them back then for them to see whatever they see. One last thought or comment?
If you, whatever you're teaching, I'm a great supporter of teaching RE to students for the exam, if it's done right.
Yeah.
I agree with you there. But whatever else is happening in the school, that has to be right too.
Yeah, fair enough. And I think we're going to have to wind down, Frank, sorry. But I think you're making a great point about the question. So often as teachers, we say, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? What am I going to tell them? The first question for the teacher should be, what am I going to ask them? What am I going to ask them? And how will I get them involved? How will I get them thinking for themselves rather than just telling me back what I said, what I told them? Pure recall. I think we're capable of far better. I said at the beginning, if I come in and say something silly that sounds strange or from a different world, just chalk it up. So take it with a grain of salt if I said something that sounded totally crazy. But do think about what you can do to support religious education. But I like to call it education for faith. Loved being with you. Blessings galore. Go with God. Thank you for coming. Safe home. Thank you.